It's All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Time now for our review of the week in state politics. Rob Schofield with the Progressive NC Policy Watch is here, along with Mitch Kokai from the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Hello, Jeff.
The longest federal judicial vacancy in the country still rests in eastern North Carolina. A judgeship for the area extending from Raleigh to the coast has been open for more than 13 and a half years. On Wednesday, the White House nominated UNC law professor Richard Myers to fill that void. The previous four nominations have sputtered for various reasons. What do you make of Myers, and is this the nominee who finally gets Senate confirmation?
Well, we don't know a lot about him. I mean, it's interesting. Although he is a law professor and he's written a lot, we know that he clerked for one of the most arch conservative judges in America. He's obviously a registered Republican. He's also an immigrant, which is interesting, a man of color. So it's interesting that in this era in which President Trump is making so much of his crusade to rid the country of immigrants and limit immigration, that he would nominate an immigrant to such an important position. But I think it just remains to be seen. I think from the perspective of a lot of progressives, they're very happy about the demise of Thomas Farr, who is the nominee that had been submitted both by President George W. Bush and President Trump, who's now back in the litigation trying to preserve North Carolina's gerrymandered legislative districts, a real far-right crusader. But, you know, Mr. Myers is a relatively young man, could have a very long career on the bench if he's confirmed.
I think it remains to be seen whether this is going to be a nomination that goes through, because I suspect that people on all sides of this topic are going to be spending many days and weeks now poring through the record to find out more about what this judge has done. Rob mentioned some of the interesting pieces of his background. There are others as well. Before he got into the law, he was a reporter, of all things.
Very working, frightening.
Well, working, exactly, working
easy,
for the
just
working Wilmington for the Wilmington Star News. Yeah. And one of the cases he covered that people in North Carolina would be very interested in was the death of Michael Jordan's father, who was killed along a roadside in Lumberton.
1993.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that now Professor Myers covered during his reporting day. So a very interesting background. And what little we do know about his work so far as a UNC law professor, I don't think you would say is standard down the line conservative policy implications. I mean, he's also worked on behalf of people fighting criminal convictions. So
right.
I think that will win him at least some plaudits on the other side, but I do think it still remains to be seen whether he's going to be someone who will prove to be acceptable for all.
So to glean a little more from that statement, because you made it twice, why? Because he might not be conservative enough? I mean, Thomas Farr had at least the accusations of some tawdry involvement in Jesse Helms' campaign operations from 25, 30 years ago. I don't take what you're saying. You're not insinuating that. I mean, are you? What do you mean it remains to be seen? What are you waiting for?
Well, I suspect that, as with the case of many other nominees from both sides, I mean, this was true when Barack Obama nominated people, and it's true when Donald Trump is nominating people. It was true when George W. Bush nominated people. Folks on the other side are going to pour through the records, and if they find anything that looks like in today's times doesn't fit with something that they could accept, they're going to publicize it. I mean, both parties have an interest in trying to knock down the other party's nominees. So if you could find something in his record that makes it look like he should not be on the bench, I'm sure we'll hear about it. At this point, I don't think we have heard anything.
We've not.
Yeah. And to return to Tom Farr, remember, he was not only nominated by both George W. Bush and Donald Trump, he was nominated twice by both of them. So he had his nomination knocked down four different times. Barack Obama nominated two different people who were both blocked by Republican senators in North Carolina. So this has been a vacancy that has been extended for way too long.
One last thing that might be worth pointing out is that Trump has had actually great success in getting the vast majority of his nominees through. He's had a couple of them knocked down. Actually, the few that Farr is one of them, but there have actually been a couple of nominees that have failed because they failed basically a conservative litmus test. So it'll be sort of interesting. I suppose that's a possibility that looms on this, but I've no indication that that's going to happen. But really, the reality remains that the Republicans control the Senate. It's very, very difficult to stop a nominee unless you've got a real smoking gun.
And very quickly, both Tom Tillis and Richard Burr have had nice things to say, so it looks as if the home state senators are not going to block anything.
President Donald Trump has had more federal judges confirmed in 2.5-ish years, more federal judges than any president in the history of the United States during his first 2.5 years. So he has had a lot of success on this front, as Rob mentioned, thus far. On Tuesday, a major job announcement. Xerox plans to bring 600 new positions to Cary. That was juxtaposed by news very same day that hundreds of layoffs are coming for contract and part-time employees at the State Department of Transportation. Officials there say that lawsuits and weather are the main culprits. Litigation stemming from a state law that was struck down and has left property owners seeking damages. Also, there was the weather factor. Last year, hurricanes led to cleanup costs that were 5 times more than usual. Mitch, I know you are generally a low-spend, small-government person, but with climate change advancing and extreme storms becoming more frequent, what should the state do about increasing infrastructure costs?
Well, first of all, I would push back on the way you set up the question about the fact that there will be additional costs because of climate change. That's possible, but I don't think that that's certain.
Pause real quick. You don't think with Matthew and Florence, 2 500-year floods in 3 years, does that serve as a decent enough example of extreme weather events drastically affecting the state?
They certainly affected the state. That doesn't mean that's going to be a pattern that's going to repeat from years on end, that you're going to have a Matthew or a Florence every couple of years. But to go back to the original point of this, part of this problem is something that the DOT brought on itself, the whole issue of the MAP Act, which you referenced, mm-hmm. and the fact that in acquiring property for a bypass around Winston-Salem, the DOT basically decided to put this corridor map in place and then leave property owners in limbo for well over a decade. I think everyone would agree, whether you like it or not, that when the government needs to build a road, build a school, if you have the site and you can't get a willing buyer, you're able to take the property, you give the people just compensation, you move on. I mean, if you're the one who's affected by it, you hate it, but that's part of living in a society where government has to do public functions. The problem with the MAP Act was the DOT set out this corridor map and then just sat there and didn't do anything for more than a decade. So anyone who was affected by the MAP Act really was in limbo. They couldn't build anything else. They couldn't easily find a buyer for their property because the buyer would know that they were going to be in the same limbo. And so that is a multi-million dollar problem that the DOT largely brought on itself. The issue of dealing with future storms, it remains to be seen whether we're going to have Matthew and Florence-like incidents every couple of years. That could be an anomaly, or it could be something that the General Assembly should have to plan for. I saw that Representative Torbett was one who said, hey, we need to get back here and deal with some of these issues that have led to the situation that's going to lead to these layoffs.
The MAP Act issue is an interesting near-term issue with respect to this, but this really does point out a systemic long-term problem with Department of Transportation and in general with our investment in public structures and public institutions. And clearly, the Department of Transportation is not adequately funded. And I guess I would differ with Mitch. Nobody can predict whether we'll have another Matthew or Florence in the next year or two, but I don't think there's any responsible scientist who doesn't, climate scientist who doesn't say that we are facing a growing, enormous problem when it comes to sustainability, to infrastructure as a result, not just of hurricanes, but more intense flooding and storms just through the natural course of a summer here in North Carolina. We've witnessed that again this summer. July was the hottest month on record in human history that we've measured since humans have been around measuring this stuff. I don't think there's any doubt that the climate crisis poses real challenges to just the basic fundamentals of our infrastructure in the state. And this, it's also worth pointing out that with DOT, for historically, we've laid people off. We've had them around for 11 months out of the year, and then we lay them off for a month so that we didn't have to pay them permanent wages. I think we've gotten past that now. But this point that we're laying people off to make a budget points out that we just haven't got the basic infrastructure down and the basic funding we need to sustain a large growing state in increasingly difficult times.
Set aside the MAP Act and weather-related issues, and you would still have the problem with the DOT of the fact that what largely funds transportation in North Carolina is the gas tax, and that's not a long-term sustainable option because, for many reasons, including some concerns about the climate, people are getting cars that are more fuel efficient. And if you have more fuel efficient cars, you're buying less gas and thus contributing less tax to to keep the roads up, the highways up, the replace bridges. And so that is something that before any of this came into play was an issue lawmakers already had on their radar, that we need to do something about the fact that the gas tax is becoming less and less of a sustainable option for transportation.
Agreed there.
Let's move on to healthcare. This may very well be a web extra only. We're recording this on a Thursday, and by the time you hear it, it's possible that a veto has already been issued, but here is the latest as we chat now. Legislators approved a bill this week that would allow small businesses and independent contractors to pool together for health coverage. A decent number of Democrats supported the measure in the North Carolina House. Indication is that Governor Cooper may very well veto this, partly because he's not crazy about it, and partly because this could be used as a bargaining chip in his effort to expand Medicaid in the state. Rob, is this really legislation that the governor ought to veto?
I actually did a commentary this week. I wrote a blog post about it. Absolutely. It's an end run around the Affordable Care Act. We've gotten the Affordable Care Act in place to provide some of these basic consumer protections that protect us and protect the kind of quality of care that insurance companies will cover, the procedures they will cover, the kinds of situations they will cover, and to prevent them from cherry-picking customers and all the other bad things that happened before the Affordable Care Act. And this is just the camel's nose back under the tent, leading us back to that time in which we had haves and have-nots increasingly in the healthcare system, and that's, we're going right back in that direction. That's what this is all about, and it definitely needs to be vetoed.
This is caught up, of course, in the fight about Medicaid expansion and every other aspect of health care that the legislature and Governor Cooper are fighting about. If there's a veto, I think it's going to be largely because Governor Cooper wants Medicaid expansion, and he sees this as something that would address an issue without addressing his issue. Some people have asked whether this veto could be sustained, unlike the other vetoes he's had this session. That remains to be seen. I think it would be very easy for a Democratic legislator who voted for this bill to see a veto, read the governor's veto message, and say, well, the governor brings up issues I hadn't thought of, so I'm going to side with the governor. It would be much easier for them to do that than to stick with the Republicans on a veto override and thus incur the wrath of Roy Cooper and the Democratic Party. I foresee that if there is a veto, then I think a lot of that Democratic support for this measure will start to dwindle away.
Right. I think that's right. And I think, you know, one of the reasons it passed is because there were a lot of high-paid lobbyists representing companies over there trying to push it, and there wasn't a terrifically organized opposition to the legislation. But I think now that the governor, if and when the governor actually puts his stamp of disapproval on it, I think that will change a lot of minds.
I didn't say it, but unlike Rob, I actually do think it's a good bill, and it's one that would help a lot of small businesses be able to provide insurance for their employees that they can't now.
This dovetails nicely into our final topic. It's now day 47 of a state budget impasse, no end in sight. Really doesn't feel like an end is within the political atmosphere at the moment. On a related fiscal front, we learned recently that the state has a roughly $900 million surplus. However, without a new state budget or any separate legislative action, that money ostensibly sits for the time being. Senator Phil Berger has floated the idea of a rebate check to North Carolinians. Where would you like to see this money appropriated to? Specifics, please.
I would like to see most, if not all of it, go into the rainy day reserves. I mean, that's when you have one-time money that's one of the best things that you could do, especially since we had to use up a lot of our rainy day reserves to deal with the hurricane. You know, a rebate from the position of tax policy, and Rob and I are going to disagree on a lot of pieces of tax policy, but I think one thing that we might agree on is that a rebate check is kind of a gimmick. I mean, it doesn't have any long-term impacts on your economy or in fiscal. It may have a very short-term stimulus, but a lot of people will see a rebate check and say, this is the only time I'm going to get this, so let me just pay off a couple bills or stick it in the bank for bills I know that are going to come up. Rebates tend not to lead to any long-term economic benefits and tend to be more of a gimmick. I would rather see the money go into the bank because we know, and especially if the two of you are right and we have more climate-related issues, then the DOT or other departments are going to have to deal with some issues. It would be nice to have an extra $900 million in the bank to deal with.
I'm sure if Senator Berger had his druthers, it would actually be a check with his picture on it and his signature, and maybe it would go out about a week before Election Day or something like that. I think I recall a time in our state when the Department of Insurance used to do something along those lines, actually.
Under Democratic leadership?
Yes,
just
absolutely.
For clarity?
No, okay, absolutely. Right. The late, great Jim Long used to use that tactic.
With his phone number, 1-800-JIM-LONG.
You're kidding.
No. He had a 1-800-JIM-LONG was his insurance call-in line.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's important for us to keep in mind, this is, you know, it's a trend, as Mitch points out, it's a transient surplus. This is something that kind of ebbs and flows. And it's also important for us to keep in mind and not to get too carried away with the idea of surplus. The reality is that we still have vast unmet needs in the state. It's just that there were some pretty conservative estimates as what we would bring in terms of revenue. You know, the stock market's been on a roller coaster this year or this week. The next time it takes another plunge, these revenues could go way down very quickly. So I think probably something along the lines of a rainy day fund investment probably does make sense, but we should also use this as a point of reference to remind us of how we are systematically underinvesting in so many essential services and structures in the state, including transportation, we just talked about, education, healthcare, prisons, courts, environmental protection, so many systems in our state that are starved for resources, and it's sort of a silly situation that we haven't more adequately funded them, and instead of using a system like this where we've got money coming in and we're not sure what to do with it.
But I would much rather have this problem than the problem that we had in the decade of the 2000s, which was year after year, what are we going to do about the budget shortfall? I mean, there was one year when we had $2 billion plus shortfall. That causes all kinds of problems. And so if you're going to have the problem of what to do about the shortfall or what to do about the surplus, I'd much rather have the latter problem.
Sure.
Mitch Kokai is a senior policy analyst at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff.